Then let's get started. I'm going to talk about CA Sync, a new project that I have been working on. By the way, if there's people standing around here, that you can actually go up there as well and look down here if you still want some more closer look on this. I'm going to talk about CA Sync. CA Sync is a new project I've been working on. It's a system for synchronizing OS images from the internet to your devices. It's supposed to be a generic tool, so this is a talk that hopefully is interesting both for embedded developers and for server people, but also actually for desktop people. So it's supposed to be generic infrastructure. Nothing specific. It's not a product. It's just a building block you can build your stuff from. So yeah, the name CA Sync is supposed to reflect the major two inspirations that led to CA Sync. The first one is content addressable. Content addressable file systems, I'm pretty sure everybody of you already came in contact with, because that's what Git is, meaning that you have a hash that identifies some blob of some kind, and you use the hash to reference it. So the address of that content is the hash. And then there's another concept which all of you probably also came in contact with, which is rsync. Rsync is a generic file synchronization tool. There's actually a very interesting algorithm behind it. Most people who use rsync probably ever never come into contact with that amazing algorithm. Most people just assume it's kind of like a SCP that works better, right? But actually, it's way more than that, and it's pretty exciting technology that people invented in the 90s or something. And I think it's technology that deserves, like, this rsync algorithm that deserves a lot more room in the light, because it's so awesome. CA Sync is just the combination of these two ideas: content addressable file systems and the rsync algorithm. So what does that specifically mean? It's a content addressable data synchronization tool. It's a file system tree synchronizer. It's basically supposed to speed up synchronizing file system trees if you have multiple of them and they are large but very similar. The use cases I already mentioned, that are if you want to update your OS, if you want to update your containers, if you want to update your IoT devices, your VM images if you have them. It's about delivering the initial image as well as about doing updates. Later on, it can have different related use cases as well. One of them being synchronizing your home directory or doing backups, right? Like, the big difference is in the first use case, like delivering images to clients, it's about downloading something from the internet and installing locally. In the case of home synchronization and backup, it's the other way around, right? Like, you have something on the individual device and you push it into the cloud. The actual problem sets are very similar, but also distinct in some cases. That's why for now we only focus on the first bit, but the later bit hopefully comes later as well. CA Sync, in contrast to rsync, is a tool that can actually work on two different layers. One of the layers is a block layer, right? You can actually use it to deliver file systems on the block layer. I mean, actual raw file system images, like a XT3 image that you read from disk, or a SquashFS image, or whatever you have. It can also operate on the file system level. That's how rsync does it, right? Like, that we actually look at the individual files and directories and the metadata about them and serialize them. The fact that it does this makes it actually particularly powerful. Different use cases might want to deliver things on different layers. Like, for example, if you do IoT stuff, it might be interesting to deliver images on the block layer, right? Like, you want to have your SquashFS and you want to deliver it as SquashFS, and should always be a SquashFS. Other use cases, the file system level is more interesting. Like, containers traditionally, like Docker and these kind of things, deliver their stuff as a tarball, hence they operate on the file system level. So, in that area, it might make more sense to operate on the file system level. I mean, then Snap, like this Ubuntu desktop app thing, actually works on the file system level as well. So, I mean, really depends on your use case, on what you're designing stuff for, whether you want to operate on the block layer or on the system level, and it's both okay. So let's actually have a technical look at what CAsync now really does and why it is an interesting concept. For that, we'll just discuss what it actually is doing if you upload or download an image with CAsync. The first step of that is, of the uploading now, it's we serialize all things, right? On the block layer, that's actually easy. We just read the sectors of the disk, right? Like one after the other, and have a serialization because, I mean, that's actually what a block device is. On the file system layer, it's almost as easy, and everybody's used to this kind of stuff because it's, yeah, effectively tar it up, right? Go through all the files and directories, put them in a specific order, store some metadata about it, and turn it into a big, long stream. That's the first step. The second step is now split up the serialization, right? Specifically, we take the serialization and chop it up into a series of chunks. Now, the interesting thing about this is we don't chop it up into chunks of the same size always, which is what traditional systems do. What we chunk it up in chunks of varying sizes, where the sizes depend on the contents of the blocks, right? So the same data should result in the same chunk size individually. Why this complexity of having varying size blocks? This is to deal nicely with if you have multiple images that are very similar but also different. Because let's say you have version 1 of your file directory tree and then version 2 of the file directory tree. And it changed very little. However, a couple of bytes were inserted somewhere in a text file where you noticed you made a typo and mistyped a comma for a full stop and you wanted to fix that, right? So you added a couple of bytes and removed a couple of bytes or something like that. Now, if you made this change, and if we would chunk everything up into equally sized blocks, this would basically mean that from that point on where your change actually was made, all the blocks following would change as well, right? Like, because a few bytes might be added to these blocks so that to the end they have to be removed or the other way around, right? So this is kind of a ripple effect. If you use equally sized blocks all the time, it basically means up to the point where your first change is, the blocks will stay the same. Everything after that will basically explode and become a change. If you, however, use varying sized blocks where the block size is derived from the contents of the block, you can protect yourself from that. So ultimately, what you get is that, the block immediately surrounding it will change, but as soon as enough time or enough bytes have been processed afterwards, you're back in the original chunk size logic, so you actually get back to the same chunk size as before the change. The algorithm, this is actually what the rsync algorithm is about, right? This is the stuff that the people who invented rsync actually came up with. So that it only in rsync, though, becomes visible if you actually have two file system trees where two files, like in the source and the destination tree, actually carry the exact same name, because only then rsync actually starts doing its rsync algorithm. If the file system trees have the same files but they have different names, then rsync is not able to optimize anything there. So, the way this actually works with recognizing, like deriving the size of chunks from the contents of the chunks is by using a so-called cyclic hash function. It's basically, I mean, we could actually use any hash function, right? Like anything like that is remotely similar to a cryptographic hash function even. But it would be pretty inefficient if we did. So what actually happens there is that we go through the data streams through our serialization and hash the first byte and the second byte and then with the first, second, and third byte and the first, second, and fourth byte and so on. We do this in a sliding window of the entire serialization stream. And yeah, for every combination, basically, we calculate the hash function and then we do a test. With the resulting hash function of every single byte ultimately, or every single window at every single byte position. The test used is this modulo operation here. Actually, I mean, it doesn't have to be exactly this modulo operation. This is what we use in CAsync for a couple of reasons, but you can use anything else. It basically just, like, Yeah, it's a modal operation, and by like h being the hash value that you calculated at a specific position, q being something like a value which allows you to pick the average chunk size, right? So under the assumption that the hash function would be close to perfect, this would basically mean by picking q, we can make it more likely or less likely to put a chunk cut at a specific byte. Right? So, on top of this, doing this hash trick that we basically calculate the hash function on every single byte for the window and do the test, we also enforce a maximum and a minimum chunk size. Meaning, even if the hash tests very early on, we ignore, the test succeeds very early on, we ignore that until we reached a certain minimum amount of bytes. And similar, if we reached a maximum amount of bytes with our chunking, without actually having ever tested the test successfully, we force a break so that, basically we can say our chunks have a minimum size and a maximum size, and an average there somewhere in between. By picking Q, we can select the average chunk size. After we did the chunking, right? Now let's recapitulate. After we serialized everything, after we chunked everything up, we now have these little blocks, all of different sizes, that together result in the original stream again. We then take each individual chunk, calculate the hash value of it, a strong hash function in this case, right? The original one, the cyclic one, which we used for the chunking, is only used for the chunking. Now that we have chunked things up, we forget about all that and apply a strong hash function, a cryptographically strong hash function, to that to make this chunk recognizable, right? What we actually do here is SHA-512/256. That is something. It's a standards defined hash function that is basically SHA-512 cut off at 265 bytes, and with a different initialization. The reason why we use this is actually because we want something relatively short, but something that is relatively quick to calculate. And on most CPUs of today, SHA-512 is actually faster to calculate than SHA-256. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter which cryptographic hash function we use, as long as we use a good one. At the same time, where we go through all these chunks that we just generated and calculated the hashes of all of them, we write out an index file. An index file is ultimately just a list of these hashes, right? Hence, the index file identifies the original stream perfectly. Because it basically just is a list of chunk identifiers, and if you put the chunk identifier, like the chunks belonging to these identifiers, back together in the same order, you're at the original stream again. Now, after we did that, we actually go through all the chunks we generated, and we hashed, and we stored the hash value off, and compressed them individually. Then we place these chunks in one special directory, we call that the chunk store. The file name being the hash function, the hash value generated for it. And we do that in compressed fashion. What the compression we actually use these days is ZSTD, but you can actually choose whatever you want. You can do it with XZ. XZ is a little bit slower, but compress is a little bit better. ZSTD is kind of the new industry standard, I guess, for people who build new systems, so we use that too. This chunk store is really a very, very simple thing, right? It's really just a directory where you have a couple of files that happen to be named after the hashes, and you can actually go to these files, uncompress them on the shell with the ZSTD tools, then pipe it into your SHA-512/256 tool and verify that each chunk actually contains exactly what the file name suggests. And after we have done that, it's all complete, right? So again, we took the original, we originally serialized everything, we chunked it into pieces, we calculated the hash function of each of these pieces, we took the hash and denoted it in the index file, we compressed the individual chunks and dropped them in individual files in the directory. That's what happens if you package up some kind of directory tree or some kind of file system image with CI sync. You, as output, like as input, you put that in, and as output, you get one index file and one of these store directories, right? So to make it very brief here, serialization, chunking, hashing and indexing, and compression and storage is the chain we calculate here. So let's now think about the other operation, extracting it again. For that, we simply reverse this. First step is we acquire the index file. Again, the index file was this list of hashes, simply referencing the chunks. Second step, we acquire and uncompress each chunk file from the chunk store listed in the index file, right? So now we have the original serialization back, well, after concatenating them. And then, we have the serialization. We simply deserialize that again. We thus regenerate the original block device data or the file system tree. And that's already it. It actually fits on one slide, the extraction there. Now you may wonder, how does it actually compare to systems that are actually that are in some ways related to this? First of all, rsync, which is again one of the major inspirations, but other systems have similar properties, like OSTree is one I want to mention, and RESTIC, which is a backup tool, but the other like similar systems like Borg or something like this. For us, it's really important we forget the file boundary, right? Like all the other systems tend to put a lot of value on the file boundary. Rsync, for example, it iterates to the file system trees, and the rsync algorithm actually never, as mentioned, never is actually used until on the source and on the destination, there are two files found that have the exact same path, right? Until rsync finds that, the rsync algorithm isn't used. So for rsync, the file system boundary is everything, right? The file boundary is everything, right? Like it's how they think, it's how the algorithm works. It first operates, like looks for the files, and then it applies the algorithm. CA sync doesn't do that. In CA sync, we give up the file boundary. We really, really don't want the file boundary, because caring about the file boundary means that small files translate into small blocks, and large files into large blocks. If you, however, first serialize stuff, giving up on the file boundary, you have this nice effect that small files are lumped together, right? Like if you have multiple small files, they become one chunk all together. And then on the other hand, large files are split into individual chunks. So on average, you get your average chunk size that we're actually looking for. But you neither have overly small ones nor overly large ones. This is actually a key difference. Like I think, for example, it's one of the weaknesses of OSTree that they do not give up on this file boundary, because for them it basically, I mean, Unix directory trees traditionally have a lot of small files. Like look into Etsy, there's things like Etsy hostname, Etsy hosts, Etsy fstep, and usually those files have less than a k bytes or something like that. And if you always generate one object out of that, one chunk out of that, then you pay heavily, because you will have so many small chunks around. This way our chunks are evenly sized, and we can even recognize similar blocks in different files, right? Which is something that rsync can't do. In rsync, if you rename a file on disk, right, like on this source, something that last week was called foo is now called bar, and then you rsync it to the destination that had a copy of foo, rsync is not smart enough to notice that the file is already there, just under a different name. Because again, the file boundary is everything for it, and the way into it is the file path, and hence it will not recognize that. For us, it's different. We don't care about the file boundary. And we hence neatly handle renames and things like that, because we actually just care about contents. So why do we all do this? Similar file system images will result in mostly the same chunk files, right? Which basically means we can very efficiently store many related trees, right? Like think about this, you do your IoT development, you have your OS image put together, like a classic Unix system in some ways. Usually between all the versions, most of the thing actually stays exactly the same. It's just where you actually make changes where a couple of files change, right? Because of this smart chunking algorithm, ultimately, most versions will result in exactly the same chunks. They will end up in exactly the same hash values. The only chunks that actually change are the ones that you really actually modified, right? So it becomes very efficient to store many related trees. And it's not just about storage, it's also about delivering them. Another benefit is the stream is always implicitly validated, right? Because everything, like every time you download one of these images, we do a strong, because it's content addressed with a strong hash function, as we download a chunk, we can validate that the chunk actually contains what the name suggests, because the name, after all, is the strong hash function. So you get something like DM verity-like behavior. For those who don't know, DM verity is a scheme how it's like my other talk actually was a little bit mentioned that as well. It's about making block devices offline, like secure against offline modification, right? What actually happens there is that every single disk access, read access that you do is verified with cryptographic primitives to match the original version that was deployed on the system. In CAsync, we get very similar behavior because the index file has the list of all the hashes of all the chunks. And as we go through the serialization, we validate all that. So if the index file wasn't modified, we do know that the entire stream wasn't modified either. What's also cool about this is when you download these images, this becomes very CDN friendly. CDN in the sense of content delivery network, right? Because by picking this Q parameter of this modulo check that I mentioned, you can actually configure how small or how large your chunks will be in average. And this is what you want to do if you deploy your images on a CDN, because you basically can say, do I want an average relatively small chunks? If you do, the chance of reusing old versions is increased. However, you lose you pay more money because most of the CDN networks actually make you pay for individual requests, not for actual sizes. Also, the metadata, like the price you pay for the metadata, becomes a little bit higher. If you can also increase the chunk size in average, if you like, and if you do, then of course there's a smaller chance of reusing what you already have. But you have fewer requests, and so you save a little bit of money, on your side of things. So, but it's extremely CDN friendly because in average, all the chunks will have the same size. So, which is again, like for a system like OS3, that's kind of very expensive thing because, as mentioned, they end up usually with lots of very small objects, and because you pay for every single object request, this kind of breaks the neck of it. There are other reasons. When acquiring a new version of a file system image, we can actually employ this algorithm, like the serialization, chunking, things like this, on what we already have. Like, for example, on an old version of the image that we already have, or on a somehow related version of something that is somehow related, right? For example, like if you do an IoT AB setup, right? Like AB setup meaning that you have one operating system image on the system that is currently booted, and then the other one, which is the next one that's going to be booted, or that was the last one that's going to be booted, so that you basically always have one version that is in a perfect condition, while the other one is the one that's currently being updated and might be in an imperfect condition. The nice thing is, like, if you use CAsync to do updates on such a system, you can use what you already have on disk to update the other version. And because you will chunk it up the same way, because you will hash it the same way, you can then basically do cross updates and recognize all the same blocks and copy them locally instead of acquiring them from the internet. So yeah, you basically get a pool of reusable chunks from whatever you throw at CAsync to use as a pool. This is actually really powerful because it actually, you know, it's not just about using the exact, like, I mean, the trees that you can use as a pool don't actually have to be related to what you want to update to, right? For example, you can do cross updates with this. Like, for example, you have a Debian OS image or a Debian container image or something like that, and you're downloading a Fedora image for your new container or something like that, then there's a very good chance that much of the stuff that's contained in there is actually very similar, because Linux distributions don't tend to be completely different. Like, they have lots of data, like locale data and time zone data, that's actually pretty much the exact same thing on all our Linux distributions. So, because the CAsync doesn't really care what you throw at it, it tries to find similarities in what you throw at it, and if there are none, it doesn't hurt either. So yeah, there's automatic robots reusing of what was downloaded before without there having to be a historical relationship. This is very different from other systems like OS3 or things like that, which basically implement a little bit like a version control system, right? Because like what they do, like for example, also the Chrome OS updater works like this, because they generally say, okay, I'm doing an image today and I'm doing an image tomorrow, and to make it efficient for those who do this kind of update, I calculate the delta in advance, put that on a server so that people can download the delta. This sounds like a very good solution, but it tends to explode because not everybody updates his system all the time, so it's not sufficient to keep one delta around. You basically have to keep deltas around from between all the versions that you want to permit upgrades between. And that becomes ultimately very expensive, like just from a management perspective, because every single update you do, you have to calculate these deltas to every older version that you might want to support updates from. With CAsync, you don't need that, right? Like, because CAsync, there is, like, the only delta algorithm is the client requesting the chunks that it needs for its stuff, and it will automatically use what it already has, regardless if there's a historical relationship or not. Of course, if there is a historical relationship, there's a much higher chance of it reusing stuff. But if there's not, it's fine. It will still use what is usable and not use what's not. So this makes management of providing these images a lot easier, because you don't have to think about history anymore. You can just put your stuff there, and it will be used if it's possible, and if not, it's not. So let's focus on a key difference to Docker, right? Like I already mentioned this, CAsync will not do revision control for you, right? Which I think is actually, I mean, it's a key thing, right? Like revision control, in my opinion, is a very useful developer tool, but it should stay a developer tool. It's not a tool for deployment, right? Like it's not a way how you to optimize your deltas. And Docker and these things, they kind of they aren't clear on this, right? Like they have this kind of weird version control, which they also use for delivery, and it's how they work. But I don't think they should be intermixed, right? Like because for version control, you want metadata, you want information about times and whatnot, but for deployment, we don't care about all of that. Like there is no reason on the end user device to know what was the version from last week. All you need to know, yeah, this is the block device of the new one, and that's the block of the old one, if you still care. But yeah. yeah, so much about the difference to the existing systems. I mean, there's lots more, but I don't have infinite time here to talk about them. So yeah, so much about that. A couple of points unrelated to this specific thing is like one of the questions people might ask is, as mentioned, CAsync can operate on the block layer, and it can operate on the file system layer, right? When it operates on the file system layer, it does something that is pretty much tar, right? It goes through the files and directories, serializes everything so that it can chunk it up later. So the question is, why don't we actually use tar? Because we don't. The reason for that is we want a couple of properties that tar cannot provide. So we came up with something, or I came up with something called CA tar, which is, I mean, you can actually use CA sync in this mode as well, right? Like you can just tell CA sync to generate a .ca tar file from a directory tree, and it will be pretty much, I mean, then no chunking or anything like that will happen, but you will still get the serialization and things like that. Not sure why you would do that, but you can if you like to. So CA tar is a lot like tar, but it's strictly reproducible. Right, like, and that's, I put a lot of emphasis on this. That basically means that one directory tree will result in the exact same serialization always, right? Which is a property that tar doesn't have. In tar, because it's very, very weakly defined, basically you can put the files that are in the tar in any order you like. And actually, that's what most operating systems do, or most implementations of tar do. They do them, they put the files inside of the directories in the order that the file system actually passed them in to the application. And that can be anything. So it really depends if you use XT3 or ButterFS, it will already be in a different order. And actually even worse than that, because file systems, even the same implementations, tend to not have a well-defined order in which they return stuff. In CA tar, all of that's not permitted, right? Like, there is only one valid serialization of one directory tree. So, yeah, another big benefit of CA tar that tar doesn't have is it's random access, right? I want this ability that if you have serialized everything and you want to jump to file so-and-so in that directory, that you do not have to go through all the beginning of the stream until you find that file, but that you can actually look at the serialization and jump directly to where you need to go, right? So these are the two big things that TAR, that classic TAR does not provide, that I think are very, very crucial for a system like this. So random access is kind of cool because it basically allows you to mount the CA sync archives, the CA TAR files, locally as if they were a file system. You basically get a read-only file system there. Let's talk a little bit about the artifacts that CA sync will generate for you. So we have the, let's actually see if that works. We have the CA IDX stuff. These are the index files that I mentioned, basically lists of hashes. CAIDX is a index file that references a directory tree, right? When we operate on the file system layer. CAIBX is the same thing, but it's about the serialization of a block device, right? Ultimately, they're exactly the same file format, exactly the same stuff. They're only named differently to give the user a hint what they actually reference, like are they on the one layer or the other. Then there is CATAR as suffix. I already mentioned that. That's basically when you don't do the chunking and all that stuff, but you just want something like a better TAR that is reproducible and mountable. And then there is .castr. It's actually a suffix for a directory instead of a file. And that's basically a store directory. It's where we put our compressed chunks, right? Like if you CD into that, and you can, then you'll just see all the chunk files in there, nicely compressed, and you can verify them with your shell tools if you like to. So this is just to give you a little bit of feeling of what actually are the artifacts that you'll see on disk. Something I forgot to mention when I talked here about the reproducibility of the TAR serialization is metadata, right? Metadata means all the stuff that you store about files that is not the contents, meaning, for example, M times, like modification times, user stuff like ownership of files and things like that. Metadata is a big thing, right? Like because metadata, when it shows up in a serialization, often conflicts with your reproducibility. Right? Like, for example, M times. In some cases, like, for example, if I would back up my home directory CA sync every day, I actually care about M times a lot because I actually want to know if I worked on that document today and on that document the last week. But for OS trees, that actually doesn't matter. It usually hurts because you want reproducibility. I mean, we had talking about reproducible builds, right? Like if you run GCC on your C program today and tomorrow, and it generates exactly the same output, then that's a cool thing. And if you then fuck it up by giving them both different M times because you ran it at two different times, then you lose a lot. So the point I'm trying to make here is, depending on your use case, you actually have to control what's kind of metadata you actually want to store, right? So if you built an IoT image, you probably do not care about M times, but you do care about file ownership, about permission bits, and these kind of things. So in that case, you want this. In the case where I back up my home directory, I do care about the M times, but I probably do not care about things like user IDs, like numeric user IDs and numeric group IDs, because I want the abilities that I can extract this on some other machine where I have a slightly different UID or GID, and I don't want this to conflict, right? So the corollary of that, we probably should have a way how to control precisely which metadata gets stored and restored in the serialization. And that's what CA sync actually provides you with. So you have a couple of switches. This is actually supposed to be dash dash with and dash dash without, but LaTeX found it funny to turn it into one dash. I don't know why, but sure. So when you invoke CA sync, you actually have these with and without switches, and you can specify precisely what kind of metadata you want. Do you want M times? Do you want ACLs? Would you want extended attributes? Do you want the ButterFS concept, like subvolume and things like that? So we are usually, like by default, if you don't specify anything, we are as precise as possible, right? Like we actually go into a lot of detail about saving and restoring your file system trees, in a lot more detail actually than TAR goes. Like for example, because we can store ButterFS subvolume information for you, we can store like the change address stuff. Like for those who know Linux well, there are a couple of additional file system attributes that you can attach to files to make them immutable and things like that. We can store, save and restore that for you as well if you like. Some use case might be useful. So Yeah, so much about metadata. CI Sync puts you in control, depending on your use case, to pick exactly what you want, if you want more or if you want less. Another point that is interesting to discuss is SquashFS images. I already mentioned SquashFS a couple of times. SquashFS, for those who don't know, is a compressed file system for Linux. Usually, compression and chunking conceptually conflict, right? Like, because compression is supposed to remove all the entropy of your stream. And that basically means, I mean, the purpose of compression ultimately is in a way that if you make one change at the beginning, that this will explode into the rest of the stream. This is, of course, exactly what we don't want with CI Sync. However, one would assume then that SquashFS and CI Sync kind of conflict, but that actually they don't. Or because SquashFS is actually a random access file system, right? Like, it's efficient to access the file at the end of the file system. They don't actually compress the entire thing from top to bottom in one single stream. What they instead do is they have some structure how you can find files, and then they have some structure how you can find individual blocks, but the blocks are individually compressed, right? So this is actually helps us a lot, because they don't have one compressor that goes from the front of the serialization all the way to the end in one go, but they have actually a compressor that starts with this chunk, then ends with a chunk, and then starts with a chunk, and ends with this chunk, and so on. So what we can do now is we can actually synchronize that up, right? Like, because if they do this kind of chunking on some level, and we do this kind of chunking on some level, we can take benefit of that, because we still can recognize the chunks. I'm not going to tell you exactly how to synchronize them up, because I didn't do the research. There's the GitHub issue about that specific thing, though. The point I'm really trying to make is, compression by default appears to be contradictory to the chunking stuff, but actually it isn't in real life cases like SquashFS. It's just a matter of, you need a little bit of research, like how you pick the chunking size that SquashFS uses in relationship to the one that CI Sync uses. I mentioned this already. For me, reproducibility is everything, right? Like, I think security requires reproducibility. That means that if I deploy an image today and then deploy an image tomorrow, I not only need to guarantee that it's exactly the same version that ends on the machine, but I also need to provide tools that you can verify that. As a result of this, CI Sync actually has some tools like CI Sync Digest and CI Sync mTree that, completely outside of the scope of delivering images to people, are actually pretty useful to in general case. CI Sync Digest, what it does is you invoke it, and then it will calculate a hash sum on the object that you invoke it on. Like, for example, if you don't specify any arguments, it will actually operate on the working directory you call it in. And what it will do then, it will implicitly, behind the scenes, serialize the entire working directory, throw all that away, but before throwing it away, it will actually calculate a strong hash function, hash value of it, and then show you the hash value. So CI Sync Digest is a little bit like invoking SHA-256 sum from the command line with a star or something, but then actually doing that recursively for the entire tree in a completely stable and guaranteed way. CI Sync mTree is pretty similar. mTree is actually a concept that was introduced by the BSD people. It's short for manifest tree. It's basically a way how you can list a directory tree and show, like, it's a standard file format for that, for showing a list of files in a directory tree and the hashes so that you can verify them. CI Sync mTree can generate that for you too and can validate that for you as well, and generate that from an index file or from a directory tree or from everything. So, yeah, reproducibility matters, and CI Sync is completely outside of the scope of actually delivery, provides you these functions. What's kind of cool if you with CI Sync is, if you have multiple local images installed, like, for example, you have a couple of container trees, they are pretty much all closely related because they're all versions of Fedora that have been adjusted to some specific service, or they have like Ubuntu or whatever you have, then it's kind of cool if we can take benefit of the fact that in large parts they contain the same data by telling the file system about it. I'm speaking entirely about running CI Sync on the file system layer now. And for that, you can actually invoke CI Sync with a special switch that tells it that when extracting a CSync archive, like downloading it from the internet and things like that, that it should use a local pool as a source, not only for copying things over, but also for optionally instead creating hard links where that's possible. Right? So it basically allows you to, it's something that basically we copied from OS tree, because in OS tree you get this property, right? You have one file system tree and you get another file system tree, and if all the files that are identical are hard linked. With CAsync you can do the same thing. And you can do it completely generically, and CAsync will do it for you as you like. So hard links have a bit of a problem though, right? Like if you ever modify the tree, then both the original tree and the one you modify will change, right? They propagate changes ultimately between the trees. Modern file systems, specifically XFS and ButterFS and a couple of others, actually know a concept called ref links, like referential links. It's a copy and write concept. It's like a hard link in a way, so that you can have one file and have another file, and they have the same contents, that only stored once on disk. However, because it's copy and write, it will be changed. As you modify one of these two files, the unification will be split up, and you get two versions of it. Ref links are kind of cool. CAsync is able to create them for you. So basically, if you have one container tree already unpacked, and you call CAsync to unpack a related other container tree, then CAsync will use the first one as a pool, will recognize similar blocks, and then use reflinks to make sure that the second one is stored as efficiently as possible and reuses as many blocks as possible from the original one. That's actually super powerful, and I'm not aware of any kind of tool like this that can do this kind of stuff. Something else here. I mean, I got like 5 minutes left or 3 minutes left now. I got two more slides or something, but I think it's okay if I don't cover them. I'd rather go towards questions, I think. So if anyone has a question?
Thanks. Since you said that you don't care that much about the file boundary, is the transfer always an all or nothing proposition, or can you just specify a slice of the destination file system to transfer over?
So, CAsync has, you can always download only parts of it. Like, this is actually used, for example, for this thing. This is a CAsync command where you basically get a local block device that is backed by the data in that index file, right? And as it will basically give you a device node in /dev called dev SD whatever something. And as you access that file, CAsync will go and download the chunks needed for exactly that from the server. So you basically get something like an on-demand downloading file system thingy. And we can also do that on the file system layer, where you basically say, I want to mount this CAIDX or this index file that references a directory tree serialization, and want to have it locally. And we will not download it in the beginning all. We will download it as you go, and we'll actually cache the chunks locally. So it's not an all or nothing thing. It's designed to be random access, and it's designed to delay downloads until the point where they're actually necessary.
So suppose I have some other tool which wants to unpack file system trees, but has no idea how to handle device files, and I want to integrate CAsync into this. Have you considered putting bits somewhere clearly in the hash identifier so that I can tell instantly offline what kind of object I have?
Well, I mean, there is no different kinds of object, right? Like in CAsync, we split everything up into chunks, right? Like we forget everything about the context of the data that we're operating on. Like the serialization for us is just the serialization, and then we chunk it up and store it away. And at that moment, there's only chunks, right? There's no object type or anything. So I'm not sure I follow. I mean, at some point, What's interesting to mention is that actually CAsync, you can also parse the serialization already prepackaged into CAsync. Like, for example, you could actually use GNU tar to tar something up, push that thing into CAsync, and CAsync will just do the chunking and everything for you then, right? Like, how the serialization comes to be, if it's CAsync that generates the serialization or if you already pass it in, is completely up to you. CAsync works in both ways. It's relatively generic in that regard. Maybe that's an answer to your question.
Hello, my question would be, it doesn't matter whether it's block device or file system. So if it's block device, I might have like some sparse space left, like for future space, right? Like an embedded or anything. Or if I have a file system and I have sparse files, how do you handle that? Do you just deliver a single chunk for all the zeros or do you ignore it? Or
That's a very good question. So, I mean, you know, the entire system is designed that we recognize chunks, right? And these chunks can have any kind of contents, including nothing like null, right? And then if CAsync works correctly, it will recognize that you have zeros here and zeros there and zeros over there, and we'll all merge them into the same chunk with the same hash function. So CAsync automatically will recognize that and handle it the right way. That said, CAsync extraction actually is smart. So if it notices that it is extracting a series of zero bytes, it will actually automatically generate sparse files, but you can turn that off if you don't like it, right? So the idea is basically to generate the most efficient directory representation possible using reflinks, blah, 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 and also sparse files where we can. What CAsync doesn't do, however, and it has been requested, but I'm not sure I want to implement that, is that we are not capable of reproducing the exact sparse file layout of your source on the destination, right? So we will either make it less sparse or we'll make it more sparse because we don't actually store any information about where our holds in the files and where not. We just consider them zeros. Okay, that's my time. If you have any further questions, I'll be around here. And thank you very much for your interest.